All right, welcome back everyone to the Deep Dive. We're diving into a case today that I think you'll find really, really interesting. It's one that gets to the heart of something so many people deal with, renting an apartment, and what landlords are actually required to provide and what they're not. It's Solo v. Wellner out of New York.
Yeah, you know what really struck me about the Solo case? It's the seeming contradiction. We're talking Manhattan, rent-stabilized building, probably picturing some pretty nice digs, right?
Yeah, right. Not exactly your rundown, barely habitable kind of situation.
Exactly. But here we have tenants withholding rent because of some pretty significant issues. Leaks, heating problems, elevators constantly breaking down. So it forces us to ask, can tenants in a building like that, even a potentially luxury one, still claim their basic living standards are being violated? Where's the line?
That's the core of it, isn't it? And that's exactly what we're going to unpack. Does habitable have a different meaning if you're paying a higher rent or in a place known for amenities?
Yeah.
Or does the law just have one basic standard regardless of the building's status?
Let's get into the details to see how this all played out. We need to set the scene, really understand the situation the court was dealing with. So like I said, rent-stabilized building right here in Manhattan. Big deal in New York, as many of you know. And it wasn't just a few disgruntled tenants. We're talking about a significant number of residents. Around 70 tenants.
70 tenants?
Yeah. Wow. And they decided collectively to withhold their rent. Not for a short period either. This went on for a while between 1987 and 1988. And, you know, that kind of widespread action, it tells you something. There were some serious problems going on.
And I imagine those problems weren't just minor inconveniences, right?
Yeah.
If 70 tenants are taking this kind of stand.
You got it. They were reporting issues that really impact daily life. Persistent water leaks, not a good thing. Can cause damage, mold, all sorts of problems. Then there were heating failures, which in a New York winter, not fun. And on top of that, the elevators were constantly breaking down. Imagine living in a high-rise and never knowing if the elevator will work.
Especially in Manhattan, where so many buildings are high-rises.
Absolutely, and it's crucial to understand that these weren't just one-time things. They were recurring issues. So it's not like, oh, the heat went out for a day and then they fixed it. These problems persisted over time.
So how did the tenants frame their legal argument? It sounds like pretty rough living conditions, but were they focused on the lack of luxury?
Mm-hmm.
Or something more fundamental?
Well, that's a key point. They weren't really arguing about missing luxury features. Their claim centered on the fact that no matter how fancy this building might have seemed, the landlord had failed in their most basic duty to provide a habitable living space. They argued that the landlord breached the implied warranty of habitability under New York real property law specifically, Section 225B.
235B, the one that sets that baseline standard for decent living conditions.
That's the one. They said basically these ongoing issues made their apartments not fit for human habitation, which is the language straight from the law. So first round in court, what happens? The civil court actually sided with the tenants.
They did.
They did. They agreed. Landlord hadn't upheld this implied warranty of habitability, and the tenants were granted rent abatements. Basically, the court said, hey, you've got to pay less rent because these conditions were so bad.
Seems fair on the surface,
mm-hmm.
But I'm guessing that's not where the story ends, right?
You know it. The landlord appealed. And the appellate term, a higher court, reviewed the case. They actually decided to reduce the amount of those rent abatements. So here's where things get interesting. We've got a disagreement. Why did the higher court at least partially disagree with the initial ruling?
Right, that's the million-dollar question.
Okay.
What were they looking at differently? I guess it all comes down to the legal interpretation, right? What exactly does this implied warranty of habitability cover? Like, how broad is it?
That's exactly the core issue. What is the scope of this warranty? Because if it's just this a super broad thing, then any little inconvenience, any feature that's not up to par could potentially be a violation. But if it's more narrowly defined, then it's a different story.
So we're looking at RPL sections of 235B. That's the law in New York. And what does it say?
Well, it lays out this requirement for landlords. They got to make sure the place is fit for human habitation,
okay.
Suitable for the uses reasonably intended. Now, it seems that the initial trial court, they interpreted this in a way that considered the tenant's expectations. What would be reasonable to expect, given the type of lease they had, the overall impression of the building?
Ah, so maybe they were thinking, this is a Manhattan rent-stabilized building. There's a certain standard that comes with that.
That's how it seems. But then you have the appellate division. And they took a different approach. They shifted the focus away from those specific lease details and any perceived luxury level. Instead, they zeroed in on what they called the essential functions of the dwelling.
So less about the extras and more about the core necessities.
Exactly. And this is really important because it leads to the three key principles that the Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York, laid down when they ultimately heard this case. And these principles, they're really, really important. They're still cited today.
Okay, so three key principles. I'm all ears. What are they?
All right, so first, they made it crystal clear that the warranty of habitability, it's an objective standard. It doesn't change depending on what one tenant thinks or how fancy the marketing for the building is. It's one standard, and it applies to all residential leases. Doesn't matter if it's a studio apartment in Brooklyn or a penthouse overlooking Central Park.
Right. So no special treatment just because you're paying a higher rent or living in a nicer area.
Exactly. Same basic standard across the board. Now, the second principle, this warranty, it's about protecting tenants from conditions that really affect their health and safety. We're not talking about a minor inconvenience. We're talking about things that could potentially make someone sick or put their safety at risk.
Got it. So it's not about just keeping the place looking pretty. It's about actual well-being.
Precisely. And the third principle, this is the one that really sets limits on this warranty. The Court of Appeals, they stated very clearly that you can't expand the responsibilities of a landlord under this warranty just by putting more stuff in the lease agreement. So even if your lease goes on and on about all these high-end amenities and services, if the landlord doesn't provide them, that doesn't automatically mean they violated the warranty of habitability.
Interesting. So even if it's in the lease, it might not fall under this specific law.
Right. There might be other legal avenues for the tenant, but the warranty of habitability, it's about something more fundamental.
That makes sense. So you could have a situation where, let's say your lease promises access to a rooftop deck.
Yeah.
But the landlord never gets around to building it. Now, you might be pretty annoyed.
Right.
And you might have a case for breach of contract, but it's not necessarily a violation of this warranty.
You got it. And that actually leads us to the crucial test that the Court of Appeals set forth. The question to ask is this. Do the problems with the property actually prevent someone from using it as a residence, as a home? The focus is on those essential elements, heat, hot and cold water, electricity, working plumbing, a building that's not literally falling apart.
So the basics, the absolute necessities.
Exactly. If those things are compromised, then you're in the territory of a potential breach of the warranty of habitability. But if it's about extras, that's where you might need to look at different legal arguments.
Okay, so the court has these three principles. But how did they get there? What was their reasoning?
Well, Justice Levine, he wrote the majority opinion. And he really emphasized the legislative intent behind this law. What were the lawmakers trying to achieve when they created this warranty of habitability?
Good question.
His argument was that they were setting a minimum standard of habitability, a safety net for every residential tenant in New York State. No matter where they live, how much rent they pay, they deserve a place that meets those basic standards.
And it's not just his opinion, right? There's something in the law itself that backs this up.
You're thinking of the non-waiver clause, right?
Yep.
Exactly. So Section 235B, Subsection 2, it includes this clause that explicitly says tenants can't give up their right to a habitable living space. Even if they sign a lease that says they're waiving that right, it's not legally enforceable.
So the legislature really wanted to prevent landlords from getting around this.
Absolutely. This warranty, it exists independent of whatever's in the lease agreement. It's this fundamental protection. And there's this really great quote from the opinion that gets to the heart of it. Justice Levine talks about the essential functions which a residence is expected to provide.
Essential functions. I like that. That's a good way to put it.
It is, isn't it? And then they give specific examples of what they mean. Heat, hot and cold water, electricity, sanitation, a structurally sound building. And it's just as important to note what they don't include. They implicitly and sometimes explicitly say that things like a gym, a doorman, those are not essential functions.
So if you're a tenant dealing with issues beyond those core necessities, like that broken down elevator we talked about, what does this ruling mean for you?
Well, it seems pretty clear. If the landlord isn't providing a promised amenity, maybe it's that rooftop deck access, maybe it's a swimming pool that's always closed, your best bet is to pursue a different legal claim, a breach of contract claim specifically. You'd have to argue based on what the landlord specifically promised in the lease agreement.
So different legal strategy than claiming a violation of the warranty of habitability.
Exactly. Because that warranty, it's laser focused on those fundamental conditions needed for a safe and functional living space. It's about ensuring that everyone has a basic level of housing decency, regardless of income or what kind of building they live in.
Okay, so we've unpacked a lot here. If we zoom out, what are the bigger implications of this Sala v. Wellner decision?
Well, you can see it as having this dual impact. On one hand, it's a victory for tenants, right? It provides this solid protection against truly terrible living conditions. It sets a floor, a minimum standard. But on the other hand, it also draws some pretty clear boundaries. It prevents this warranty from being used to enforce every single clause of a lease agreement.
Right, limits things a bit. And I can imagine some people might see that as favoring landlords, especially in places like Manhattan, where you have these high-rent luxury markets. Like, shouldn't tenants paying top dollar have higher expectations that are backed up by the law?
Yeah, that's a valid point. But the court's reasoning is essentially this. We have a distinction in the law between protections that come from statutes, like this warranty of habitability, and agreements that are made through contracts, like your lease agreement. The law provides a safety net. But if you want those extras, those are contractual issues.
So the law is there to make sure everyone has a safe and functional place to live. But it's not necessarily going to guarantee you a hot tub on the roof just because it's in your lease.
Huh. Exactly. And, you know, for our listeners who are studying law or working in this area, Sala v. Wellner is a perfect example of why it's so important to understand those distinctions. A breach of the warranty of habitability, that's about those core essential elements. A breach of contract claim, that's where you focus on the specific promises made in the lease. Two different legal strategies, two different sets of arguments.
So just to really drive this home, a broken heater in the dead of winter, that's a potential habitability issue. A broken treadmill in the building's gym, not so much.
Yep, exactly. And you know, it makes you think. We see more and more apartment buildings with all these amenities these days, rooftop gardens, dog spas, you name it. I wonder how these principles established in Sala v. Wellner will continue to play out in this evolving landscape of residential living. It'll be interesting to see how those expectations and legal strategies adapt.
That is something to think about. And on that note, we'll wrap up this deep dive into Sala v. Wellner. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.